Tuesday afternoon, the 3rd of November, and we continue with the questions which we have before us, which we still have quite a number here. Well, the next one's a hearty annual. Comes up every year. Do you call the organized Seventh Adventist Church Babylon? Well, if you want to... This is the classic question, of course, the Seventh Adventist asks us when they first meet us. And all they want to know is yes or no, and their full and complete decision is made forever so far as the message is concerned. This is the grand test question. And I like to think of this in the same terms as if a Roman Catholic was to come to you and ask you the question, now tell me one thing, do you call the Roman Catholic Pope the Antichrist? And of course, if you say, yes, I do, they say, well, that's enough, and away they go. Because they are quite sure that the Pope of Rome is God upon this earth. But naturally, of course, if you have the opportunity of having them come and go through a series of studies and learn the prophecies of Daniel, the Revelation, the Everlasting Gospel... The time comes when they see for themselves that their great Pope, of course, is the Antichrist. And we know, of course, in Testminster Ministers that and selected messages, there are those many, many statements where Sister White says, anyone who comes calling the Seventh Adventist Church Babylon is not sent of God, don't listen to him. But you must remember that statements like those must be understood in their context. And certainly, back in the days when Sister White spoke those words, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, as it was then constituted, was not Babylon. But times have a way of changing. Now, for instance, let me give you a proof of this. In the early part of his ministry, when Christ cleansed the temple, what did he say? Must you make my Father's house a house of merchandise? But a scant 3.5 years later, the same Savior looked in upon the same building and said, your house is left unto you desolate. Had there been a change? Why, certainly. In the first case, it was my Father's house. In less than 3 years, or less than 4 years, just about 3.5 years later, it has simply become their house. And what is more, it was left unto them desolate. Now, let's take a look now at the three great cities in the world. First of all, we have Babylon. Secondly, we have Israel. And thirdly, we have Egypt. Those three. Now, Babylon, as you know, is a symbol of apostate religion. And apostasy, of course, at the point where the people of that church have gone beyond the point of return, wherein they have rejected the very last call that God has given to them. It doesn't mean simply a church which is still walking with God, but a church which is truly apostate. Israel, of course, is the truth of God. And Egypt is atheism. Outside of this, there is no other church upon this world, no other power apart from these three. So I ask you to decide for yourself just where the Seventh-day Adventist Church stands at the present moment in relationship to these three. Let's ask ourselves the first question, is she an atheistic church? No, so therefore you cannot call the Seventh-day Adventist Church Egypt. Does she have the living truth of God? Pardon? She did, but does she now? No. Well, can you call her Israel? Well, what else can you call her? You have no option, have you? Now, this does not lay us open to the attack of Testimonister ministers. And here's why. I'm not afraid to call the Seventh-day Adventist Church organization Babylon, because that's what she is. And we should call a spade, shouldn't we? and do it without any fear of contradiction. You know, Martin Luther, he said back in his day, he said the Pope, the bishops and so forth could all make, need not make a noise. He said, we are the church. And so we are. And so was he back in that time. Now let's go back to the march of Israel from ancient Egypt, clear through to the promised land. There we are. Now you find the Seventh-day Adventists will tell you that the very same organization which left the land of Egypt finally entered the promised land. And to the superficial thinker, that may appear to be the truth, but it's not. The strict truth is this, that the surviving remnant of that organization entered the promised land. That's the truth. Now you come back, for instance, I don't recall all the different shakings which took place, but let's come to one of the large ones. Remember the three men, Korah, Dathan and Abiram, led 250 princes of Israel, who in turn led a great multitude of God's people in revolt against the truth. In other words, here was a vast company who got off the path and out of the light and created in Israel a crisis which demanded a decision and which ended up in a separation. That is, some of the people went with Moses and God, and the rest of them went with Korah, Dathan and Abiram. So that which had been one movement became two movements. Now could they both be the Church of God? No. Impossible. Because the Church of God doesn't divide like that. One of them was straight out defiant, open rebellion and apostasy. The other was the Church of God. And yet, but a few days before, they had both been a part of the same movement. This group here, this great part of Israel, never did enter the promised land. They fell out and were left by the wayside. Then you come a little further, and about the next serious event in Israel's history was the brazen serpent. When they murmured and complained on the way south from Kadesh Barnea around the land of Edom. And again, there were thousands of Israelites who perished because they separated themselves from God and were left behind in the desert. Then we come to the sin of Baal Peor on the banks of the Jordan River, when Balaam caused Israel to sin over adultery and licentiousness. And again, thousands upon thousands of Israelites were slain and left behind in the wilderness. Now those who entered the promised land were those who had come out successfully on the right side of every crisis that had overtaken that people since they left the land of Egypt. And that remnant was God's true people. What were the rest? Apostates who were led dead in the wilderness. Now let's compare the journey of modern Israel from Babylon back in 1844 when they came out of Babylon down until, well, the end when Jesus finally comes, and we'll put 1970 round about here. Let's just look at the picture of things along the way. We come forward a few years, we have first of all the Messenger Party, then we have the Marian Party, later we have Kenrite. Then we have the Shepherd's Rod. Now, let's go back to the Messenger Party shortly after 1844. They rose up, I think, in 1856, if I remember correctly, or thereabouts. Now, they were a group of people who lost their faith in the spirit of prophecy, had no time for proper church organization, who lost their faith in the teaching of the sanctuary, and about all they retained was the seventh-day Sabbath. That was all they kept. Now here is the point. In 1856, the Seventh-day Adventist Church was not organized as a general conference as it is today. And when that time came, that which had been one body became two. And don't think of this as being down, this as being up. Think of one becoming two like that, like the fork of a road. One going left and the other going right. Now the people back in those days had to decide whether they go this way or this way. And what was the only question that they could look to decide which way they would go? The only question, is it true or false? Isn't that right? The only question. Now, Sister White, of course, she went where the truth was, naturally and certainly. And a large number of believers went with her. Others went the other way. Now, here was a group here which was the Church of God here, but you can't say the two halves of that original whole were still the Church of God, but only one half remained as the Church of God. You see the point? Now, we can illustrate the same thing with all these businesses here, but when Sister White spoke those words around about in the early 1900s and said the Seventh-day Adventist Church is not Babylon, of what company of people was she speaking? Was she speaking of those who had been originally a part of that church? Or was she speaking of those at that time who were still the survivors of all these crises? The answer is clear, isn't it? Very good. Let me turn to Testminster ministers here and read you a clear statement of this fact in the chapter, The Remnant Church, Not Babylon. I just find it here. I just don't see it right off. Oh, here it is, page 50. There is but one church in the world who are at the present time, note those words, at the present time, standing in the breach and making up the hedge, building up the old waste places, and for any man to call the attention of the world and other churches to this church. Now, which church? Yeah, which was doing these things, right? Denouncing her as Babylon is to do a work in harmony with him who is the accuser of the brethren. Is it possible that men will arise from amongst us who speak perverse things and give voice to the very sentiments that Satan would have disseminated in the world in regard to those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus? In regard to whom? Those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. Now you show me today those people who are the true continuation of that people, that is, those people in this world who are standing in the breach and making up the hedge, building up the old waste places. That is, where's the next bit? Those who are keeping the commandments of God and do have the faith of Jesus, you show me that people and I'll show you the true Seventh-day Adventist Church of today. Right? And then, let any man call that church Babylon, and they'll come under the denunciation of this statement. Now you know, of course, that down in 1950 to 1962, I suppose we might as well put, during that period of time, there came upon the Adventist world a crisis of tremendous proportions. That crisis began with the question as to what the Adventist Church would do with the 1888 message, and it was followed by the question as to what they would do about the overtures of the Protestant churches. And how did the Adventist Church at large come out in that crisis? On the right side or the wrong side? On the wrong side. And only a tiny remnant of us stood upon the right side. Therefore, the Seventh-day Adventist Church organization in that time took the same position as the Messenger Party and as the Marian Party and as Dudley M. Kenwright, in that they lost their faith in the sanctuary truth and in the spirit of prophecy, which today they read only to suit themselves. Isn't that true? And if the spirit of prophecy says do one thing, what do they always do? The opposite. You think of a few things. The spirit of prophecy says not to pattern their educational systems after the world. What do they go and do? Pattern them after the world. The spirit of prophecy says no drug medication. What do? Go for drug medication. The spirit of prophecy says not to build large centralized health institutions. What do? Just that. In other words, let the word of God say don't do it, and what do? They go and do it, right down the line. So they came out on the wrong side of that crisis there, and that being so, they are not included in that stream of people whom Sister White said you cannot call Babylon. Do you see the point? In other words, show me today where the truth of God is, and I will show you where the Seventh-day Adventist Church is. And we are the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And nobody else in the world is. Because, what are we doing today? Are we standing in the breach? Now what is the breach? The breach is the gap which is made in the law. And the great gap which is made in the law is made by taking away the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because when you take away the gospel, what happens to the law of God? It's shattered to pieces, isn't it? It's broken and it's smashed up. We're going to have a study before too long, which I'll give you just a little preview right now. You know, I can show, I shouldn't put that up, the Word of God plainly says that God really never planned to write His law on two tables of stone. That law, written on two tables of stone, is a fitting symbol of the people to whom that law was first given, and of all legalists ever since. Now here shall we draw the law on stone. Now what is stone? It's cold, it's dead, it's inanimate, it can't produce anything at all. And the hearts of the people to whom that law was spoken were what kind of hearts? How do we know? Because of what they did. Would men and women with hearts of flesh build a golden calf and worship it? Why, of course not. Never. Now with the finger, with his own finger, God wrote on those tables of stone his law. And the voice of God, speaking from Mount Sinai, wrote on the minds of those stony-hearted people those 10 great words, his 10 commandments. But they couldn't keep them, nor did they keep them. They didn't have the gospel. And therefore they made a great breach in that law by bowing down to a golden calf. And as Moses came down the mountain, he smashed those stones to fragments. A symbolic act showing what those people were doing. But when we today take up the living gospel, what does that do to the law? What does it do to it? It magnifies it. It puts it back in its right place. It repairs the breach made so long ago. And making up the hedge. And what's a hedge? A defense, isn't it? A protection. And what is the protection of God's people? Again, his law and the gospel. Building up the old waste places. Now, what people upon the earth today alone are restoring the old forgotten truths that have been lost because of apostasy? This people, right. And for any man to call the attention of the world and other churches to this church, which church? The one doing these things, denouncing her as Babylon, is to do a work in harmony with him who is the accuser of the brethren. Is it possible that men will arise from among us who speak perverse things and give voice to the very sentiments that Satan would have disseminated in the world in regard to those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus? Today, the Seventh-day Adventist Church organization is no longer in that stream. She doesn't meet the specifications, so you can call her what you like, except for one thing. Don't call her the Church of God. Anything else but that. She's not the Church of God in any sense of the word at all. If she was, we'd be back in her midst, most certainly. Turn now to Romans, the 9th chapter, just to finish off this question with this principle, as Paul argued it here in this particular chapter. You see, the whole basis of modern Seventh-day Adventism's claim to being the Church of God lays upon the argument of physical descent. Romans 9 and the first 6 verses of this chapter, first 5 verses of the chapter, Paul is declaring his faith in the origin of the Jewish church and acknowledging that God did call that people to be his people. Let's read those words. I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost, that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart. For I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom pertaineth the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises, whose are the fathers, and of whom, as concerning the flesh, Christ came, who is over all, God blessed forevermore. Now see how Paul stood up and declared his faith in the call of Israel. Now what do we do today? This very morning we declared our faith in the call of Adventism into the world, didn't we? We believe with all our heart that back in 1844, as a direct fulfillment of prophecy, coming in at the right time under God's leadership to do a certain work, the Seventh-day Adventist Church was called to be God's church. We believe that. And there's no argument at all about what God called Adventism to be. That's not the argument. Any more than back in Paul's day, the argument was certainly not then over what God had called Israel to be. The argument is instead a question only of what they have become. That's the argument. And so it was back there in the days of Paul, when he had the same problem there in his defense over his separation from the Jewish church.
That is, now don't forget this next verse, that is, they which are
the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise accounted for the seed. And then Paul goes on to talk about Abraham and Isaac, and Isaac's two sons, Jacob and Esau. Now let's look at something here. Here we have Abraham. This man had two sons, the first of whom was Ishmael, as we know, and the second of whom was Isaac. Who today are the direct descendants of Ishmael? The Arabs. Very good. There they are over in Egypt, of course, North Africa, and over there in Asia Minor. Today, of course, Isaac in turn had a son, two sons whose names were Jacob and Esau. And the descendants from Esau are today's Jews. Very good. Now in Christ's day, when he was upon this earth, remember how to prove that they were the church of God, the Jews said, we have Abraham for our father. Remember? But the Arab could have popped his head around the corner and said, I have Abraham for my father. And how would the Jew have felt about that? He would have said, no, you're a Gentile. You have no claims upon the truth of God. You're a Gentile. But the Arab could have repeated, but I have Abraham for my father. And inasmuch as your claim to be God's child is the fact you have Abraham for your father, then that fact must make me a child of God too, mustn't it? And it would have too if the Jews' claim or argument could be accepted before God. But with God, remember, the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God in any sense of the word at all. What is the only test that we can apply when asking ourselves, who is the church of God at the present time? Where is the truth of God? Correct? And when you found the truth of God, the saving, living power of the gospel, then what have you found? The church of God. You know, today, the simple fact, it's no good my denying or trying to cover up the fact that we believe the Seventh-day Adventist church to be Babylon. That's impossible. Because the very fact that we're separate from the church in itself is a declaration that, to all practical terms, that church is Babylon. If it wasn't Babylon, where would we have to be? Back in her congregation. But how could we be? You know yourselves, if we went into that church and desired to live the lives that we live, just live the lives that we live, what would they do with us? They'd persecute us. I'll never forget down at the New Zealand Missionary College when I was a teacher there. They used to get selected feature films, Hollywood productions, of course, and show them in the social evenings in the college. And some of these films are films of violence, of war. For instance, The Wooden Horse was shown there once, that marvelous escape from that prison camp in Germany. Then there was the story of a dog that was parachuted into Norway with an English parachutist, and how they got out of the country again after much shooting and killing and violence along the way. And all this was shown in colour. And the time came when I said to my family, that's no place for a Christian to be. And we quietly quit going to these films. We did not rise up against the school and spread leaflets around and denounce what they were doing. We just quit going. That's all we did. And you wouldn't believe the persecution we got just by doing that. And then, of course, we began to live more carefully and healthfully and wouldn't partake of the great feast they had there at certain times of the year. How do you suppose we got to be treated? Again, they couldn't take it. But we couldn't go back in that church and sit still with a message like this, could we? How could we? If we went back into the church, we expect to have proper fellowship there, to be given Sabbath school lessons to teach, church sermons to take, prayer meetings to conduct, to be able to speak up in Sabbath school and so forth. And what would we find in just no time if we attempted to carry this message in the church? You know the answer, don't you? I'll never forget back in Arkansas, I think 3 years ago now, the folk out there had been meeting with some Seventh-day Adventists in a little sort of isolated church. It was a conference church. No, it wasn't a branch, it was a proper church, but it wasn't contained in itself. It was sort of attached to the conference because it was so small and so isolated. And when I was due to come, our folks, Sister Cornish and the others, said to these folk, well, Brother Wright's coming on date so-and-so. He'll spend Sabbath here with us. And, of course, when he comes, we'll be spending our time with him. But they said, if you'd like him to come along and take the study here for the day, I'm sure he'd be willing. Well, some said yes and some said no, but finally they agreed that I should come. So I went there and thought this is a very, very fine opportunity to preach in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And I stood up and I went to great pains to say nothing against the church itself. I preached no prophecy, I simply stood up and preached acceptable confession, a study of course which you all heard. And I began by going to the sanctuary service, the sins of ignorance. Then I came to that part where we began to show that sin is what I am, and there's a stiffening of bodies around the room. Then we got to the place where we began to show how the sin is literally taken out of the person, and that's when the roof came in. They jumped to their feet, they began to interject and throw questions at me, and that study never got one word past that point. They throw a question at me. I say, well, I'll answer it for you. And I start to answer it, and they throw another question at me, and then another question, and the first question still wasn't answered. And they were so excited and worked up that you never saw the likes of it. But after a long time, I said, look, I said, this is the Sabbath day. And God never planned that we'd spend the Sabbath day in heated, angry debates. I said, you invite me to give a study? Obviously, I said, you don't appreciate the message we have to bring. So I said, that's all right. We'll close the meeting and we'll quietly withdraw, and those of us who love this truth will fellowship together this afternoon on our own. Oh, I said, no offense. I said, we didn't want to offend you. I said, we're not offended. I said, I'm just being practical, that's all. And so we left. And that day I had a revelation all over again of what the Seventh-day Adventist Church thinks of this message. And when I was down in Washington, D.C. in 1965, when my wife was over with me the last time, we went to stay in the home of Dr. Murdoch, who was once the president of the Australasian Missionary College. And when he was down there, both my wife and I were students at the college. And they employed Margaret as a house help there, and that's how she helped pay her tuition through school. And they'd become quite attached to her. She wasn't just a servant, she was quite a friend in the home. And so when they knew we were in America, they gave us a special invitation to go over there. And it turned out that their primary objective was to lure us back into the church again. In fact, Dr. Murdoch promised me that if I'd come back to the church, just come to America, he'd get me a fine job in the work, my children could go to church, school and college, and everything would be just heaven upon this earth. The promises he made to me were all gilt-edged, believe me. But I said to him, that won't do any good, because they would never have me back in the church with this message. Oh, he said, Fred, that's okay. We believe the same thing. It's just a matter of misunderstanding. And all you need is to get a fresh start in a new country. That's all you need. Well, I said to him, let's you and I settle down and spend a little time just working out what we really believe. He said, fine. So we sat down together, opened up the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy, and for about 4 hours, we went to work on the message. And he kept on saying, well, that's what we believe. There's no difference. But I said to him, you haven't got the point of what we believe. And at last he saw it. At last he said, Fred, do you mean to tell me that you believe that God is literally going to take my sinful nature out of me and give me a different nature in his place? I said, that's right. And he closed the book and said, Fred, the brethren will never accept that. Never. And that was the end of our conversation. He closed the book and he closed the discussion. From that time on, it was the weather, the price of cars, how things were going in Australia, and next morning he left for Philadelphia to carry on with his education. And again, I had underlined in my mind the truth that this message is a red rag to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It's not wanted at all. When I think back to those 10 long, difficult years when I sought and struggled for a living experience to get the victory over my sin problem, the story I've told you so often before, and when this message came to me from outside the church, independent of it, and brought me a living experience of salvation, then I have a responsibility to share that with all those who wish to hear it. And I know that you folk today in this room are very grateful for the fact that I chose to leave that church and travel around the world so I could come to you with this truth. A thing I could never do if I stayed inside its borders. Never. I'd still be down there in Australia obeying her dictates and commands, and she would thus have proved herself to be an effective means of keeping this message contained in a very, very small area. So I have no fear today in saying that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is Babylon. And if that's too hard to hear, well, I'm sorry. The truth is the truth. Yes, that's right. Is the organized Seventh-day Adventist Church Babylon. That's what I mean, the same as the Bible says Israel and Israel. It means two different Israels depending on the context. And you know which one I mean, don't you? I don't mean this Seventh-day Adventist Church. Oh, I see what you mean. Thank you very much. So that in brief, and of course I spend considerably more time on this question if need be. I mean Matthew 22, Matthew 25, all those great prophecies plainly show where the Seventh-day Adventist Church is. After all said and done, let me ask you this question. When the Jews hung Christ upon the cross, what were they? Apostate Israel or were they Babylon? Of course they were. And they are Babylon in the worst form. In that form where the church slays the true messenger of God by going to the state and having the state execute the church's commands. That is the papacy, isn't it? Absolutely. And of course, you know the statement, don't you? I think it's in 265 in Testminster Ministers. What about this statement where Sister White says, and the context is obviously the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It couldn't be any other church. The world must not be introduced into the church, has it? Why, surely. And married to the church, has it? Right. Forming a bond of union? Good. Through this means, the church will become indeed corrupt, and, as stated in Revelation, a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. 265 in Testminster Ministers. 265 Testminster Ministers. Now, the facts of the case of these, that Sister White said there in effect that if the world comes into the church and becomes married to the church, then just so certainly will that church become Babylon in its worst form. Because the statement is taken straight from Revelation chapter 18, where it speaks of Babylon the Great being fallen, and declares that when Babylon the Great becomes fallen, she becomes a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. So those who say the Seventh-day Adventist Church can never become Babylon are denying the plain statement found there in Testimonies to Ministers, page 265. They're denying, of course, and they'll have to claim that today the world has not come into the church and been married to the church, forming a bond of union, which of course we know perfectly well it has. Well, as I said, there's much more we could say on this. We could go through the Old Testament and read those great statements about the Jewish church, against which Paul had to stand, and yet when truly understood, there was no problem, because they don't teach what the Jews desired that they should be used to teach. Any further questions on this point? Oh, I got you all convinced. And in brackets, Seventh-day Adventists who have had great light, which have exalted unto heaven in point of privilege, shall be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which have been done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee. At that time Jesus answered and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent in their own estimation, and hast revealed them unto babes. And that's about what we are, aren't we? You know, I did. I said it. Review and Herald, August the 1st, 1893. Perhaps I'll just put this on tape, I think, if you don't mind. I'll just repeat that again. Now it's a great mistake to attempt to talk to anybody, anywhere, and convince them of this point about the church being Babylon, if they have not, first of all, had Babylon dethroned from their hearts. Because the second angel follows the first. Now, I believe with all my heart that Bob Brinsmean came as the preacher of the first angel's message, because the keynote of his presentation was that the hour of God's judgment is come. And he preached that message not between 1950, but up till 1962, the last 4 years in particular. And then it was that at that time there came the experience of separation between us and the Brinsmeads, and the Brinsmeads went back to the church again. Did I ever tell you folk the story of what happened back then in Australia then? Experience?
No, I don't know if you've heard of the details.
Would you like to hear it?
Yeah, we'd like to.
Well, it's quite a story. Perhaps I'll spend just a moment. What I want to impress upon your mind today is the fact that when that separation call came in 1962, we absolutely had no plan to preach it, no intimation that was coming. Now, I never sat there and said, I'm going to be the one to preach the second angel's message. Never. Rather, I suddenly found the thing dumped in my lap, if I may use the expression, and then we had to carry this squalling baby, this very unpopular little squalling thing, and we had some pretty hard times doing it. I'll just go back a little bit and give the brief history of what took place, and it's rather an interesting story. As I said before, I first gained the living experience of this message back about 1954, and remained with it in the Seventh-day Adventist Church for the next 6 to 8 years. From 54 to 1960, I taught it to whoever wished to hear it, under a growing cloud of suspicion and distrust on the part of the church. But then, in 1960, I came to my last year at the college. 1961, I worked out on a farm in New Zealand, and 1962, I returned to Australia shortly after I'd been disfellowshipped from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, Bob Brinsmean had come to America in 1960, as you'll remember, and I went to Australia after a very successful period in New Zealand of preaching Romans 7 and 8. Of course, as you folk recall, who know me back in 64 when I first came to America, we've come a long way since that time. But the path we have come since that time is still built solidly on the message we had back at that time. I can still stand and preach Romans 7 and 8 today, word for word, as we taught it back then, and you'd find no disharmony between that and what we have today, except we have, of course, a great deal more light and more clarification upon the same message. And when I went to Australia, I knew that the Brinsmead group in Australia absolutely needed Romans 7 and 8. Because letters coming across to New Zealand showed me that they were looking forward to the final atonement as the great day of cleansing. That in the meantime, they expected to have carnal natures, they expected to hate each other, they expected to scrap and fight and be divided and so forth, and they were doing just that too. Well, I said all they need, of course, is to be taught about the victory over sin, and the believers in Australia will welcome this with open arms, just as the folk have done down here in New Zealand. So, I had some things to learn, believe me. I wound up in Australia in March 1962, and I went straight away to stay with my father-in-law, Adventist minister up in Warwick. And pretty soon we were crossing swords, because I got into his church in Stanthorpe, and gave some studies, and he got to hear about it. Oh my, he sure was angry about that. So we left there and went to live in our own home down on the coast. And then the Brinsmeads organised a kind of a Welcome to Australia meeting for me at Benora Point in the home of the elder Brinsmeads, Bob and John's father. Ray Martin came up all the way from Victoria, a distance of about 1,200 miles, to the meetings. And there were folk present from all over North New South Wales and Southern Queensland. We had a room packed with about 60 or 70 people that particular day. And they said, well, they said, Fred, if the meeting is yours, stand up and give us a study. Now, I didn't even think I was on trial, but I was. Because I thought that I had their confidence and they had mine. And I stood up and began to give Romans 7 and 8. And you should have seen the reaction. Those Brinsmead people, they began to quibble and argue and fight back at me, and the further we went, the more heated it became. Until I said to them, now I'm amazed at this reaction, I said, because all I'm doing is preaching Wagoner and Jones, and furthermore, I said, what I'm preaching you'll find in Bob's book, God's Eternal Purpose, on page 126, word for word. So I said, what's the fuss about? Well, that's cooled them down quite a little bit. But they looked at me rather darkly. And from that day on, while they couldn't openly fight against me without denying what they stood for, yet the main leaders, such as Hope Taylor, that was Bob Brinsmead's sister, and one or two of her stalwart followers, watched me like a cat watching a mouse, and I was marked from that point on. Well, now the general conference came up that year. I'm coming to the main points. I should mention too that down in Australia, Hope Taylor actively campaigned amongst the believers to have them withdraw their tithe support from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. She openly and actively campaigned along these lines and support Ray Martin and myself with this income. Don't let anyone ever tell you that the Brinsmeads didn't stand for a separation in the early days. True, when Bob came to America over here, he ran into a lot of wealthy supporters who were very strong on let's stay with the church. And that cooled him down considerably so far as separation was concerned. And Lionel Taylor, that's Hope Taylor's husband, Bob Brinsmead's brother-in-law, who with Hope Taylor were the kind of guardians of the movement while they were away here in America, they openly said the Seventh-day Adventist Church is finished. And they openly said the Seventh-day Adventist Church does not preach the third angel's message in any sense of the word at all. Well, the news finally came through just before the general conference session that Al Hudson was putting out a paper. Someone had written from up here, down there, and this letter told that Al Hudson was putting out a paper in which he was calling all the believers around the world to get back into the Seventh-day Adventist Church again. And that Bob Brinsmead and he had a big cleavage, and that Bob was going dead ahead against the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and Hudson was going to call all the folk back into the church again. Well, we didn't have a telephone at our house at that time, I don't believe yet. It came a little later than this. And they called up another brother in Moolumbar and wouldn't tell him what the agitation was all, the excitement was all about. But I was supposed to ring back. But by the time I called back, Hope Taylor had left her father's house in Benora Point and was headed back to her own home in Brisbane, about 80 miles north. Well, and what she's going to do is she's going to rush home and get a pen and write a letter to all the believers in Australia denouncing Al Hudson right to the ground and calling on the believers to stand fast against the Seventh-day Adventist Church, to stand behind Bob in his warfare against the General Conference. Well, I was filled with amazement and consternation at what this might do. And so I waited till she got home and I called her up and I said, Hope, I said, look, I said, let's don't do anything rash, because we don't have verification that what this brother has written to you is the truth. The Bible says two or three witnesses. How do we know he is the mischief maker? I said, and if we go ahead and denounce Hudson, who stood so much behind the message, we might do him great injustice. I said, look, I said, Hudson paper can't get out here by surface mail for the best part of a month or more. And it only takes me about eight days to get an answer back from America, about 3 to 4 days each way. Just wait till I write personally to Hudson and the Bob and get the facts straight from them. And then I said, we can act when we have proper authority. And I had to plead with her to act sanely in the question. And finally she agreed. But mischief maker that she was, she still wrote privately to a large number of people and denounced Hudson privately, although she didn't put out the official circular letter. Well, I wrote to Hudson, I wrote to Bob, and they both wrote back and said the story had no foundation in fact, that they were both united, they were both working together, and while there was, they saw things in a slightly different light, that generally speaking they were working harmoniously together in the carrying forward of the message. Well, that was fine. So I told this to Hope, and she was a bit sour about it, because she felt, I think, that it showed her rashness up, and she'd been proved wrong, as you might say, and she didn't like me any better for it. Well, I tell this part of the story to emphasize how absolutely confirmed the Brinsmead base was at that time on separation, how completely anti-Seventh-day Adventist Church they were. Now, so far as my position was concerned, I didn't preach separation, I didn't agitate it, I didn't call for tithe, I simply went up and down the land preaching Romans 7 and 8, because my great burden was to have each and every believer experiencing a new birth experience, and that's still my burden, as you folk know. Well, about this time, down in Moolumbar, about 80 miles to the south of Brisbane, and I suppose you folk would be helped if I drew a little map here of Australia. You know, here's Cape York Peninsula, coming down like this. I'm not what you'd call the world's best cartographer. There's, coming over here to West Australia, it runs up here like this somehow. There's the Gulf of Carpentaria. Now, Queensland is this huge state here, on the northeast coast of Australia. Then we have New South Wales with Victoria coming up over here like this. This is Victoria, and this is New South Wales, which is the most prosperous and large and the biggest state. Then over here we have Northern Territory, and we have South Australia, and here is West Australia. Now, Moolumbar is right here in the far north of New South Wales, and Brisbane is the capital of Queensland, about there. We presently live just north of Brisbane in Queensland, a place called Palmwoods. Have you ever heard about that place, Palmwoods? Well, it's a world-famous name nowadays. The Brinsmeads live at Benora Point, just north of Moolumbar. There, Benora Point. Very beautiful spot, believe me, a very beautiful spot. They have a lovely place up on an elevation with deep red soil, and they look out over the blue Pacific Ocean with great golden beaches south and north of them. It's a very, very beautiful spot. Grow anything. at all. You name it, they grow it, excepting, of course, for the stone fruits, apples, pears, peaches and plums. We need a little higher elevation for those just there, but they'll grow pawpaws, bananas, passion fruits, grapefruit, everything. Well, we down here in Mwollumbah, where I was located that time, we had a lovely group there, and a number of them still stand for the message. And every Friday evening we got together, and there was no study given, but we'd sit down and we'd start tossing questions into the middle of the room, as you might say, and we'd get a discussion going. And if someone during the week had some bright thought, we'd put it on the ring and we'd soon see if it was bright or not. And if it wasn't bright, it'd be tossed out. If it was good, we'd develop it and we'd learn some wonderful things that way. And I appreciated those days because the spirit of confidence amongst us was such that we could ask any question, no matter how way out it might appear to be, and nobody would jump up and say, heresy, heresy. They would say, well, that's worth thinking about. And we'd look at the Word of God, and if we found it didn't stand up to the truth, it'd get tossed out. Otherwise, we'd keep it. Now, as we were studying there, the firm conviction came upon our minds that the first, the second, and the third angel's messages were being repeated. Now, I want you to bear in mind that at that time, we did not have the statement in here where Sister White said they would be. We didn't know that. Nor did we yet have the statement where Sister White says the parable of the 10 virgins has been and will be fulfilled to the very letter. We didn't yet have those statements. Well, so we chewed this over, and you know, the more we thought about it, the more we realized the truth of it, because we were all confirmed separationists at that time. None of us went to church at all. We met ourselves and had a very, very precious time together. And we agreed that Bob Brinsmead had been God's messenger to carry the first angel's message, because he preached the hour of God's judgment has come and had really brought a mighty test to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But we said together, and this is no discredit to Bob Brinsmead, that God would raise up another man to carry the second angel's message. Just as Christ followed John the Baptist, just as Fitch and Litch followed William Miller, just as James White and the others followed those who gave the second angel's message, and just as we today follow those who have been in the past. Now, of course, I had no idea in the wide, wide world that I would be the one who would have to carry the second angel's message. That wasn't in our mind at all. We just thought God would raise up someone somewhere. We didn't even speculate as to who it might be, and we never dreamt that we'd be doing it, because I thought my mission in life was to preach Romans 7 and 8. That's all I ever had the ambition to preach. The ambitions we have sometimes are kind of limited, aren't they, to what God has in mind for us. Well, so we were tossing this back and forth, and the thing developed quite a little bit, and so we got this expectation. But bear in mind that we did not, in saying this, have in mind that Bob should be superseded. It was just God's way of doing things, which you folk will recognize. Well, then, we were right in the middle of this, and we didn't tell this to Hope Taylor, by the way. We knew better to do that. And for the first time, a man came up from Sydney whose name was Reg Bladbourne, and I'd looked forward to meeting him for a long time, and he came into my home, and he hardly got in when he began to really tear the Seventh-day Adventist Church apart. Oh my, he sure was bitter against it. And I said, well, I said, that's interesting. I said, but don't worry about it, because we've had some good time studying about this lady, and I just laid out before him my thoughts, our thoughts on Bob having given the first angel's message, and someone would follow with the second angel's message. So he looked at me, and he went straight from where I was up to Hope Taylor, and he told her. Talk about poor fat in the fire, or gasoline in the bonfire, it just went whoomp. I tell you, her reaction was something to see. It really was. She jumped up, I believe, she slammed the fist on the table, and she said, nobody, she said, nobody will ever succeed Bob Brinsmead. She said, God's given that boy the message and he'll see the church right through until Jesus comes, and nobody will take his place. And she said, this will be the end of Fred Wright, she said, we'll eliminate him. And she set to work to do it. She jumped in a car, she ran all over Brisbane and gathered together all the believers up there. And she said, Fred Wright calls the church Babylon, she said. If this gets back to the church, we're finished. And This is amazing to me because they've been going up and down the land for months declaring the Seventh-day Adventist Church was finished, declaring she never taught the third angel's message, calling on all the folk to draw their tithe out of her, and now suddenly I had never done anything as bad as that. And now they turned around me and I was the number one criminal in the world because I was supposed to have called the church Babylon. And all I had said was that someday someone would come and preach the second angel's message. Well, I got to hear about this after a few days. And you know, I've never been to such an agonizing experience in my life because I could see at that time that the movement was going to blow to pieces from inside, just fall apart. Now, I should mention, by the way, that the General Conference in San Francisco was just over before this took place. And as that General Conference approached, those of us down there in Mwollumbah bent upon our knees night after night, and we pled with God to somehow have the people in the General Conference consider and take up the message. I mean, we were serious about it. We didn't want to see the church turn the message down. We loved the Seventh Adventist Church. We loved our brethren. We longed to see that church take up the message. And all my life, I've never been one of those who's gone round digging out all the faults in the Adventist Church and denouncing her and spending all my time criticizing her, as you folk are witnesses to. But the conference had come and gone, that hadn't happened. Well, I telephoned Hope and I said, Hope, what's the trouble? I said, what's all the excitement about? She said, you call the Seventh-day Adventist Church Babylon, she said. She said, the believers up here are ruthless, and that's the word she used, ruthless with anybody who does that. Well, finally, I said, well, look, I said, couldn't we get together, I said, and talk this over? I said, you come down to a place called Bean Lee. Was it Bean Lee? Now, a little further north of now, I've just forgotten its name now, and I'll meet you halfway. Because I didn't want to meet her with all the people around her that she had stirred up. I wanted to meet her on her own and talk the thing over quietly. And Brother Lloyd Evans was going to go with me, the two of us would meet her, but she refused to meet me. And I'll tell you something. It's a strategy of the Brinsmeads that they will never meet an opponent unless they have first gathered overwhelming numbers around them, and they try and maneuver so you meet them alone. So you're one against a pack of mine which already are converted in that particular direction. But she said, we'll come down on Sabbath to Terranora, which is just to the west of Benora Point, and in the hall there we'll have a meeting about it. Very good. So we agreed. I tell you, I went out and I prayed for long hours that night, pleading with God to save the movement from disintegration. That's all I could foresee. All I could foresee now was disintegration. So Sabbath came, and we all went up there in the afternoon, and about 60 or 70 folk got together. And I stood up and presented, first of all, essentially the Brinsmead's own position on the nature of Christ, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church's position in relationship to that. I repeated their own statements about her being the Antichrist, which is but to say she's Babylon, anyway. And when I was finished, I sat down, and then Hope got up, and she really, really repudiated all she said before. She said before the Seventh-day Adventist Church was finished, now she said it was God's church. She said before we shouldn't pay a tithe outside the church, now we must pay our tithe to the church. She said before that the church didn't preach the third angel's message, now she says it's the only church preaching it. And she called on all the believers to go back to the church again. And I tell you, I was never so amazed in my life at that. That complete changeover. A month before, Hudson was the worst man in the world because he was going to lead the folk back to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And she was going to denounce him all over the world for doing it. And now she was calling all the folk back to the church herself. I tell you, that was an experience. And we went out of that meeting, and I knew, of course, that, the meeting ended up on this note. Hope said, all right, she said, we've had a fair discussion. I wondered about that remark. Let's go home now and study about it and pray about it for a week, and then we'll all come back again, she said, and study some more. Well, off she went. On the way home, apparently someone made a remark to her about what they thought we'd do, so she raced home and got a duplicator out and put out a letter denouncing me and calling upon folks to withdraw their tire support from me and leave me high and dry and stranded. Well, I tell you this, I went home that evening to my place in near Mwollumbah, a very, very dismal person. And I said, well, that's the end of my ministry. Because I hope Taylor has called upon all the faith to quit their support. And obviously, of course, if you lose your financial support, you've just got to go back to work and you can't travel, you can't preach the message, you're finished. All you can do is a very limited lay work. And that night I lay down in my bed, and to me the end of my work had come. I said, oh well, I said, I've served God as long as He wanted me to, and I'll just go back now. I won't be stuck for employment, I can do lots of things. And I was just about to go to sleep. I was still quite wide awake, when it seemed as if I was conscious of a presence in the room. There was no glowing light or any such thing, but just a great sense of peace in the room. Then almost audibly, just hold a minute, I want to get this on this tape. Hold your machines. This day, you have done this day's duty. That was the sweetest thing I've ever heard in my life, I tell you. This day, you have done this day's duty. And with a smile upon my face, I rolled over and had one of the best sleeps in my life. Well, the next day I got word that Hope Taylor had prepared this manuscript and sent it around, and that didn't look good, but again, it didn't worry me anymore. So, I then decided to go up to see her, and on the way I got as far as Southport, which is just south of the Queensland, just north of the Queensland border. And, thank you. And there's a young man up there who had been resisting the message pretty seriously, and he wanted to see me badly. And so I agreed to stop and see him. Well, he took me into a back room, and he sat down, and he started to give me a real lecture and tell me how wrong I was and how I ought to change my whole position. I just sat there and listened to him. Didn't get very far when all of a sudden he quit talking and looked at me, and that was that. Now, I thought it was very strange, and then we got up and went out, and I left. Now, later he told me that he'd gotten the determination to really give me a dressing down and tell me how wrong I was, but he didn't get very far when they fixed upon him the overpowering conviction that I was totally right and he should throw in his lot and give me his full support, which he did for a short time thereafter. Well, I went on to Brisbane with the plan to see Hope Taylor and talk things over with her and try and get a reconciliation, and I arrived up there in the evening, and we telephoned her, but she refused to see me that night. So next day I went around to see her, and we talked there for quite a little while. And she was quite friendly and nice, but we stuck our ground both ways. And I walked out to the car, and she talked there to me for a little while, and all of a sudden she stopped in the middle of a sentence, and she looked at me quite fixedly for a moment. And without saying goodbye or anything else, she turned on the heel and walked inside the house, and I'd never seen her face from that day to this. Never. Now, later I learned, because Murray Robbie, who talked to me in Southport, went up to see her next day, and he found her a very agitated and upset woman. And he said to her, "What's the matter, Hope?" She said, "Look," she said, "Fred Wright was here yesterday, and as I was talking to him, there suddenly fixed upon me the overpowering conviction he was totally right in his position, and that I should stand with him and behind him and support him in the preaching of the message of separation. But," she said, "I can't do it and I won't do it." And from that day to this, Hope Taylor has been virtually a non-entity in the Brinsmead movement. Now, cut a long story short, I left her home, and I headed out, and I didn't know whether to go north to Bundaberg or west to Toowoomba or back home. I felt to go back home again would be, as you might say, the end of the road, a recognition that I was finished. And so I stopped beside the road and prayed to God and asked which way to go, and I raised my head and I just started out and went straight west to Toowoomba. And I there met a brother who's recently died, Brother, what's his name? Parrott. And talked with him, and he told me some very encouraging things. Now, do you know, and this was the astonishing thing, that when, before Hope Taylor called upon all the folk to quit their financial support of this, of me personally, we were just getting enough money in to keep us going from month to month. That was all. Then in one stroke, she took away practically every one of those supporters. Do you know that 1 week after she called them away from supporting me, we had 3 months support in advance? And where it came from, I don't know to this day. But it never came from those other, the one or two other folk popped up who'd had tithes that they'd been storing up for a long time. And they came forward with that, and we had 3 months support in advance. And that was God's vindication to me of our stand back at that time. Now, like a wave, like an electric shock, clear around the world, in the Brensby movement came the clarion call back to the church, 1962. Some of you folk may remember it. And the vast majority of them went back to the church, leaving in Australia a tiny handful of people in North New South Wales, Brother Race and his family, Brother Ludlow and his family, Brother Redcliffe and his wife, and my own family. For a little while, a couple of other families stayed with us, but pretty soon they went back to the church too and walked no longer with us. As well as that, we had three or four families down in New Zealand, maybe half a dozen families down there, and in all the world, they were the only people that I knew of that had emerged on the right side of that crisis. That's how thin the ranks. That's how thin the ranks got back there in 1962. That's how thin they got. Now, of course, Brinsby had gone ahead of me around the world, and my name had been given a very unbecoming picture over here in this part of the country. The Seventh-day Adventist Church was against us. The Reformed Church was against us. We had the most unpopular message in the world because folk could take this book, Testaments to Ministers, and say, if anyone calls you to separate from the church, he's not sent of God. So what hope did we have of getting anywhere? What hope? The hope that the truth of God was in our possession. Now, I've told you this story to show that the separation issue was not something of our devising. It came unexpectedly and suddenly out of a clear blue sky. And we had no choice at all but to stand up and be counted, and either to go right back to the Seventh-day Adventist Church or stand out in complete separation. Well, we took the unpopular choice. We took the choice that looked like disaster. And for the next 6 months after that, we had a very, very rough time until I came to the place where I felt like giving the whole thing up. But God was good to us. Then the tide turned, and you know the picture today, a worldwide movement growing in strength and vitality, and people like yourselves rejoicing in a newfound experience, knowing that you have been delivered from your old sin problem. So I believe with all my heart that it was God who led us out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And if He led us out, then how could I dare to go back in again? How could I? It would be, as it says there in the book of Luke, if any man, having set his hand to the plough, turns back, what then? He's not fit for the kingdom of God. Now, would God have led us out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church if that was still His church? Well, of course not. If that was still His church, then my place is right there inside of it. But if it's not His church, where's my place? Outside of it. And as you folk will testify, we've never been so blessed materially, spiritually, intellectually, socially, and physically, health-wise, as we have been since we left that church. Isn't that true? That's the truth, isn't it? Be my experience. Well, there's just some thoughts on that question. It's amazing, a wonderful question. Two lines in length gets me talking so long, isn't it? Now, if you'd like to ask any question on anything I've said this afternoon, then go right ahead. Bob and John showed no inclination whatsoever to do that. None whatsoever. Until one day, the story goes that Bob was out ploughing and the spirit of the devil came and picked him up and flung him on the ground yards away from the plough, and a very ashen Bob came in later, and his mother said, what's happened to you? He told the story, and he said, I'm going to go to college to be a preacher. And that's where he turned about face to go out and preach the message. Whether that story's true or not, I don't know. Lots of traditions and funny stories be spread around. But
they originally belonged to the Reformed Church.
Hope Tunnel, they were not Bob. But they got this doctrine of the Shepherd's Rod.
They did.
Oh, yeah.
What doctrine is correct?
The doctrine of the sealing and the judgment. That is, the seal of God comes before the latter rain. That's